This is Reality Check. I'm Chris Patmore, Sci-Fi London's web editor, and in this edition of the podcast, we are getting animated. First up, we spoke by phone to Alison Abate, a producer who has worked on many different animation features, including Tim Burton's The Corpse Bride and his latest homage to classic horror films, the Oscar-nominated Frankenweenie.
How did you first get into working with animation?
I moved to California right after college and just really wanted to work in film in any capacity and ended up temping at Disney right at the end of Little Mermaid. So I was really I spent one day there and got kind of swept up into the whole, I worked on a film called The Rescuers Down Under. It was right when they were sort of doing Beauty and the Beast, and it really got swept up into sort of that new renaissance of animation, and I really have never looked back.
Were you more with the old school of animation, or are you quite happy with the CGI 3D?
I mean, I think that, animation is, it's about, I always sort of choose my films based on the story and the creative team, because I feel like a medium is a medium. I mean, I have worked in stop motion. I'm working on a CGI Lego movie right now for Warner Brothers. I've done 2D animation. So I feel like you really, the mediums get too much press because they're just like a way of telling the story, but it really is the stories that appeal to me.
But you don't feel the craft of animation is slightly disappeared with the introduction of computers?
I mean, I hope that it hasn't. I mean, there is a lot of craft that goes into those computer animated movies as well, and a lot of amazingly talented artists. I mean, I do feel like 2D animation has a beauty to it and a lyrical quality that I would love to see more of. And then, of course, stop motion, which I've done so much of, I just think is just a fascinating and magical way of telling a story and making a film. So, I would be saddened to think that those guys would go away, those mediums would sort of go away. But I don't think that they will, because I think that there will always be filmmakers who, choose that language in which to tell their story. And so, I just think that you got to have the right fit of medium to material.
I mean, stop motion is still really popular. Two of the best animations this year have been stop motion.
Absolutely, yeah.
One of them you were the producer on.
Indeed, that is true.
So what do you think is the lasting popularity of stop motion?
Well, I think there's something really fascinating for audiences to see things that are really exist, that are really there on screen. And, it kind of combines the best of animation and the best of live action because, you have to build sets, you have real light on real fabric, on real, real solid items. And I think people can feel the tangible quality of that. And yet you can also, you're moving things one frame at a time, so you can sort of expand the imagination and really, really showcase new worlds and new looking, new characters. So I feel like it kind of walks that nice line between the two mediums, and I think that's why people love it.
Really, the stop motion is the original 3D animation, isn't it?
It is, sort of, yes.
Whereas computer generation is really 0-1 animation.
Yes, it is true. But, like I say, there are amazing artists that work in that, and it takes a rare sort of breed of artist and technician to really kind of work in all of the mediums, really. And so, there's really no right way, wrong way to do it. I think it has to really be what does the movie require.
And working on Frankenweenie, how did you come to work on it in the first place?
I had just was finishing up Corpse Bride with Don Hahn, with Tim Burton, and then executive producer Don Hahn had been going through the Disney archives. He was there, and he was there when Tim made the short, and said, kind of remembered that there was more story to tell, and so he kind of brought it to Tim's attention, and we had just finished Corpse Bride, like I said, so the technology of stop motion had gotten to a point where I think Tim really felt like he could finally get the performance out of the dog and the kind of really execute it in the way that he wanted. So it seemed like the timing was right. And of course, we talked to John August, we got a script going, so the process got put into gear. And then of course, we started making it in 2009.
Why do you pick John August as the writer? I mean, he has worked with Tim before, but was that part of the reason?
Yeah, I mean, I think that he did a great job on Corpse Bride, and he has that sense of, he's just so good at sort of capturing the essence of Tim's, kind of the essence of that relationship between the boy and his dog, and kind of the essence of Tim's creative visions of things. So he just seemed like he was the right person, and then what he brought to it was so wonderful, and you know, in just, you know, a few short conversations with Tim and kind of delving a little bit into Tim's past, was able to really evoke so much of what Tim wanted to get into the story just in that first draft.
And a lot of it was made over here in England, wasn't it?
All of it was made over here in England.
What do you think it is about the English that attracts them to stop motion? Because we've got Aardman, and then Paranorman was an English team that made that.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, we came over for Corpse Bride and made, you know, mostly because Tim was here, and it was like, you know, we needed to be near him, and that was important. But really, what I came and found was that there was just such a depth of talent here, and, you know, there's, you know, you can take university courses in stop motion and modeling and things like that, which we don't have in the States very much. And there is such a love for the medium, especially with the television shows and, you know, Fireman Sam and Bob the Builder and all that kind of stuff, that it seems like there's a real kind of cultural love for the medium and just an amazing wealth of talent. So I actually stayed after Corpse Bride and did The Fantastic Mr. Fox with Wes Anderson, and actually sort of put it right into that same studio with sort of similar artists. And then obviously the team pretty much rolled onto Frankenweenie. So for me, it's been great to do these movies here, and I really wouldn't want to do them anywhere else. And you're right, Paranorman does have some English directors, and then did bring some animators and stuff from London to Portland to work on the film as well.
Have you got any more stop motion projects lined up in the future?
We're talking about a bunch more, and I do think that there will be more. It's just a matter of when and where. You know, our studio space was right at the foot of the Olympic Stadium, and unfortunately we lost our space. So I think there's a lot to do to kind of find a new space and figure out what we want to do next and all that. So
the technology for making these films now has really been helped by the introduction of DSLRs.
Yes.
Do you think this has been a real boon to ahead of, you know, instead of using the huge 35mm or 60mm film rigs?
Absolutely. You know, that was on Corpse Bride that we actually kind of decided that we wanted to go and use these digital still cameras. And so that was really the movie that changed it for me and my team. And obviously we did them similarly on Fox and now on Frankenweenie. And really you can get much closer, you can do more, you know, the moves are much easier to kind of navigate. So it's really helped to free up, I think, the scope of the films and the vision of the films in a way that I think is intangible in some ways, but really, really important.
I guess because digital cameras are so cheap now, it's also opened up stop motion to a whole new generation.
The DVD release got some fun features, some fun extras, which also showcase the technology. There's a thing called Miniatures in Motion, which showcases the kind of behind the scenes of it all, and I think they did a really nice job with that. There's another short that Victor and Sparky supposedly made together before the accident, and so you get to have a fun little, you know, moment with Victor and Sparky, which is more of a sci-fi kind of movie. And then also you get to see the original Frankenweenie short. So actually I think that's really fun to watch because you can actually compare and contrast it to kind of the film as it stands today and see where Tim opened it up and, you know, what else he wants to investigate. So I feel like they did a really nice job of putting some fun stuff on there that kind of really enhances the experience.
Which is always good when you get the DVD in anyway.
Yeah, you want to get a little more than what you got, a little more than the theater. So it's a nice follow-up.
Frankenweenie is out now on 3D and 2D Blu-ray and DVD. Next up, we met with Jeff Simpson, Bill Jones, and Ben Timlett, the directors and producers of A Liar's Autobiography, the untrue story of Monty Python's Graham Chapman, which features a smorgasbord of animation styles to find out how the film came together.
Okay, this is the one that I start on. Cause, yeah. It was back when I was a child in 2007. I was a documentary maker, and I wanted to. I was interested in making a documentary about Graham Chapman. I was interested in the fact that he was a man who was openly gay but secretly alcoholic. That was an interesting tension. So I went up to see David Sherlock, who was Graham's ex-partner. I went drove all the way up to North Wales, hoping he might have some kind of materials like home movies or something that I could base a documentary on. He didn't have any kind of assets, as we call them, materials, but he did mention the existence of these audio tapes, And that set me on a journey to track those down, because I realised that when I got hold of the tapes, I realised that we could actually do a documentary with Graham narrating the documentary from Beyond the Grave. Mm. That was sadly turned down by the BBC. But
not sadly.
Well, no, in the end it was happening by the BBC, yes. But in the meantime, I had made... So we'd looked at the audio tapes, and then we thought about what are we seeing while we're hearing the tape. So I'd actually got some animation together. I'm not an animator, but we commissioned some animation to go over the audio. And so I had these kind of taste-to-tape material, and that's when I walked into Bill and Ben looking for a home for this material.
So we basically were, it was 2010,
actually.
No, 9, because of the anniversary.
And then we were just doing a documentary on the 40th anniversary of Monty Python. And so we were doing 6 one-hour episodes called Almost the Truth. And...
Emmy nominated documentary series.
Double Emmy nominated. Triple. Double losers.
Yeah.
And but we were a bit like coming out of this and doing another documentary about Graham Chapman. We don't really want to get involved in something like that. But we love this idea about doing animated Graham Chapman. That sounds brilliant. So we were like, why don't we do a whole film just with the animation?
Because originally it was sort of interviews with a bit of animation. That was the concept.
And they said, how much of this audio tape stuff have you got? And it was 2.5 hours of it. But also I think the thing was that the other Pythons wouldn't have wanted to sit down and do more talking head interviews. Mm. But the idea of them coming in and doing voiceover of the Grahams scripts was
it was an adaptation of his book, which he'd written with other people, but he'd written it. And that was also what was really exciting, is to adapt, his story. I mean, the book itself is brilliant. It's great, but it's obviously takes you on... Obviously, being a literary thing takes you on a different sort of journey. But I love the idea of trying to get animators to interpret what... trying to spend 80 minutes inside his head. Through a medium which isn't just your reading and imagination. So that was something that really excited all of us. So I think that was it. So hopefully, it's brought something, kind of an experience that you can sort of,
Yeah, I think giving it to us, sort of, hopefully more people will get to see it, and also we'll go back and read the book.
Absolutely.
Because of the film.
Yeah.
And they'll, you get people to relook at Graham again.
I think that's the other thing, the fact that Graham's not had, much of a life, being that he's dead, after Python, where the rest of them have all gone on to sort of do other things in their own right. And basically, Python gave them all the ability to ultimately do what they wanted. None of us, some of us managed to do that, but it's difficult. They they could go and it opened doors for them to do things that they were genuinely interested in. And Graham really didn't have that opportunity to to do that. So it's nice to think that people are talking about him again and you're writing about him.
In terms of what the film adds to the book, as it were, I mean, obviously it's more, as Ben said, it's more of an experience because you go through the alcohol, that very visceral scene where he's dealing with his alcoholism and stuff like that. But also what I quite like about the film is occasionally those little interview clips that are dropped in some ways they might be the remnants of the original documentary idea, but it also reminds you that he was a real person. I mean, a lot of the time he writes himself as if he's a fictional character, and writes comedy scenes about himself. But when you see him on Parkinson, you realise that, yes, he's actually a real person and what he did and that he was a member of Monty Python. I think that's quite interesting to experience that as well.
There's a lot of different animation styles in the film. How did you come up... How did you select who was going to animate in the different sections and allocate particular stories to match the styles?
We had a wonderful man called Justin Weyers, Weyers, who was our animation producer stroke animators wrangler. And we sent him out into the animation world, and I think he looked at about 50 to 60 companies. I think he put us in a room with about 20 to 30 different companies. So we'd seen their showreels, we'd seen their styles, we knew what we were interested in at that point. But then some certain companies, it was really obvious, or certain animators, it was really obvious who's that their style would match a particular section, like George Sander Jackson and that amazing coming out, drying out sequence, that very visceral oil on glass thing. That was obviously something we immediately spotted that would work well for George's style. Others, the animators pitched for one section and they ended up doing another. So it was kind of like a dating process, like an extraordinary dating process, a 3D dating process.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes it was organic, I suppose, the right way to describe it, because at times certain sections we really knew exactly what we were looking for. We had an idea in our heads that was coming off the page for us. And then in other things we got surprised by what people pitched, and people they would usually pitch on two sections, and then
we had this one guy who pitched on these two sections, and we were like, oh, we've got this other company that would be good for that section, and someone else would be great for that section. But the pictures he'd done were these see-through characters, and he actually pitched for the Ibiza section, and he had these opaque characters. Mm. And we were just sitting there thinking, actually, LA.
They're transparent people.
Transparent people. That's a wonderful style. To go into the thing. I mean, they didn't hit us straight away, but it was like, oh no.
What we had in our head was to do the LA section with cutout photographs, because that's what Graham describes. He says when they went to Frost's party, people sent cutout photographs of themselves. So we immediately thought of photographs of that. And then, as Bill says, when we saw Mateus' style, he came up with the kind of production line with the cutouts hanging on those kind of meat hook things and all that kind of stuff.
With the cutout cat people.
Yes, exactly. So we got the best of both worlds, really.
But it's wonderful. You've got the flat cutout people, and then you've got the real people who are also just flat and but slightly translucent.
Also, I mean, some animators, just you could tell straight away from their work that they got emotion, they got comedy timing.
The average age of animators, the directors of each section, is 28. A lot of them are 2 or 3 years out of college. You know, they've only made short films, you know, amazingly kind of imaginative short films. But I think in each case, it's their first feature film that they're working on. At that point, then it was, of course, just a matter of giving them a free rein, really.
Going back to the nightmare scene, the drying out section with George
Sander Jackson.
With George, he'd been out of college for like 3 or 4 years, but we saw his college film, and that was the thing. We were like, oh yeah, that's what we love. And he wasn't able to do this oil and glass technique since college, because no one could afford to pay him for that much of time that he'd have to spend to do it. And when we presented it to him, he was just like, oh yes, I can get back into it and do that style, which he really loved.
In 3D.
And then doing
that was a whole other.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the techniques of doing these animation styles in 3D, it's just, you know, it's never been done before, you know.
No, because animation is traditionally 2D.
Yeah.
Apart from the 3D stuff.
Yeah, well, the 3D stuff is all CG. It's all kind of 3D CG.
It's OD, really.
Yeah. And whereas this is. I mean, and the idea of having this, you're painting on glass and then smudging it. How do you make that 3D work? It's layers.
Yeah.
Why did you go in 3D? I mean, what at what point did you decide to go in 3D, and what was the creative thinking behind it? I mean,
it was the great creative thinking of lots of people want to commission 3D programs, so maybe we can actually get funded if we do it 3D. And
there was the other one, which was me watching. I was watching Avatar in the IMAX, and I thought, yeah, it's all right. But the best bits, those credits, they're really great. Those 2D credits that just sit off the thing. I love the textures. So that was part of it.
Well, that was
basically what I was sort of thinking. And I was thinking, well, you know, if you take beautiful 2D animation and you create those textured layers, you could do something really interesting that I've not seen before. So That, those are the ridiculous.
And of course, the credits to Avatar cost more than our whole thing together, I expect. But it was certainly in the first instance, it was envisaged as a kind of marketing aspect, a kind of marketing gimmick. But I think when it came to the storytelling, we discovered that we had another tool to play with. And even in flat drawn animation, first of all, it gives you that kind of. It just adds a little more depth to the world, and it feels a little more immersive. We certainly didn't want to play with the 3D. We didn't want lots of things jumping out. We didn't want that kind of gimmicky 3D. But we just wanted enough to give a little more depth and immersion into that world. In fact, I don't think there's any jumping out. There's probably once or twice there's jumping out the screen.
Yeah, we did try and use it, you know, creatively within the scene. We thought about the scenes and how, you know, certain elements of it. Certainly, for me, the bit that, well, I think it works beautifully. For me the scene where he's wrestling himself, you know, and then we go into the puppet world, that kind of weird theatre, and then it starts to really feel that 2D kind of puppet thing. And with the 3D, you get that depth, so you actually could be at a puppet theatre, and that kind of thing. And then when he goes and sees the doctor, and then the doctor prescribes all the pills. And then what we did is we realised that when you come out of that kind of pill. See where you see all the pills coming in, and he's throwing up, and he's taking things in, and listening to Terry Gilliam as a weird doctor. We realised we could reverse it, so you would go, your eyes would flip, so you would sort of go, you know, you're
basically things that are set behind. The idea was that things that are in front of something else is actually set behind it in the 3D. So your vision is seeing it that it's very quick. So.
Yeah, certainly there's a place where we mess with it. But it's also basically part of the emotional storytelling. The scene where they're cycling up the hill and in Ibiza, and Graham's about to, well, his horizons are about to broaden significantly as he goes in search of Lerv. And so we're actually able to stretch the horizon, and we turn the 3D up to the max there, because as he looks out over the hill, you want a little more, because he'd been in this very enclosed world of London, then suddenly he goes out into the wider world. So we use the 3D there too.
Whether anybody gets that stuff, who knows?
I keep mentioning it in interviews, so people go, ooh. No, it should be subliminal. It should be kind of subliminal thing.
Yeah, but you don't have to watch it in 3D, you know.
It was quite interesting when we chose our animators, and we got there and we decided that we got their animatics in, and we pieced their animatics stuff in, and then. But there was probably a process where, because we realised that when we sat down with one animator, the three of us just arguing with each other in front of them wasn't actually that beneficial to the project. And they were sort of all looking at each other like, what have I signed up for? So we realised that we would have to sort of split up the role of who would speak, who would be the kind of main point of contact for each animator, go in and see them and talk to them, and then come back with the guys and talk about what they're doing and show them shit and come back. But that was quite funny, because we all had our favourites, so that was a big argument. So who got who was like,
I'll trade you LA parties.
Top parts.
Yeah, literally.
I was very lucky with that, because my favourite one was Biggles, and no one else was trying to lay claim to it. So I was very happy. Well, I mean, this project had to be done animation because Graham's dead.
Yeah.
So it had to be animation, because we were wanting to use the voice from the grave. And
I mean, people tried a live action. There is a script going around for live action version of Graham's life, but it just wouldn't be the same.
I really agree. I mean, Python's films primarily are action. I mean, the obviously the Gilliam moments in the TV series are iconic, and. People love them so much. I think quite an important part of this for us was to not try and emulate Gilliam. Obviously we got pitches that were sort of people trying to copy Gilliam, and you just think, why would you try to?
We did ask Gilliam if he wanted to do it.
We
apparently
did.
He was doing a film directing or something. I don't know.
But the other thing, I mean, one of the attractive things about animation is, of course, there are no limits. There were no, you know, if the scene's set in space, if a giant spaceship comes in, and we didn't have anybody saying, oh no, you can't afford to do that or build that, because obviously you can just do anything.
We could have tried to have got Alan Bennett in a space pod and filmed him, but David Hockney, but it would have been more difficult.
Yeah.
So there's no restraint on animation. On
Liberace.
And also, I mean, a scene like the wrestling scene, I mean, that's obviously based on a live-action scene from Hollywood Bowl. But you know what we've done with that is an extraordinary piece of animation, even if I say so myself, because I'm a huge admirer of the people who did it. You know, that's
Asylum.
We're also keen to try and sort of represent the kind of switching tones in the book and the flights of fantasy. And I think the only way to do that would be to show three different styles of animation as you go through it. There's a documentary called Anatomy of a Liar, which is the story behind the story.
DVD, available at the end of February.
which takes you, where we interviewed all his friends, they take you through the scenes, actually. What?
Yeah, it's sort of a dissection of the film, and then the people who knew about Graham talking about those scenes.
And his brother also gave us this amazing, which we never, right at the end, he found it in the loft, which was home movies of Graham, 8mm home movies. And there he is with filming the Queen Mum. We've got it on film of him with filming the Queen Mum when she arrived to me.
The afternoon tea.
And she's wearing the same outfit in the same colours as the animators who'd never seen it. And then the parents in the pool as well.
Visiting him in LA.
And his mum's in the pool, and she appears in the pool in our film, and the sick. You know, it's just like...
He had a guiding hand in the film.
Yeah. Elias' autobiography is out now on DVD, Blu-ray, and digital download.